Welcome to the Onyx Pathcast. My name is Matthew Dawkins, and I am here with Dixie Cochran.
Hello.
And with Eddie Webb.
Hello.
We are here today to talk about a subject most thrilling, freelancing in the RPG industry. We are all three of us freelancers. Some people might not know it. Some people might think they are full-time employees for Onyx Path, but that isn't the case. We're all on contracts. I assume, not knowing the details of my colleagues' contracts, that they're all for finite periods that will hopefully be renewed. But
yes.
Dixie, is that the case?
Yes, yeah. I think we're all on pretty much the same contract, from what I understand.
Yeah, I imagine so. Don't tell them, audience. I'm doing my Richard III bit now. Don't. what these two fools do not know is I'm being paid $40,000 than them.
Oh, God.
How strange. There's a moment where I couldn't hear Matthew at all. I don't know what happened there.
Yeah, so he just turned aside and spoke into a microphone. Now, I shall return to them post-haste, lest they miss my parting. Anyway. Now, back on the subject of freelancing. This is what happens when you let me host. Back to the subject of freelancing. I think the most important thing we need to cover, the headline that we need to cover in this podcast, is how we actually get into the freelancing. Because a lot of people want to do it. A lot of people want to write for Onyx Path, edit for Onyx Path. They want to contribute art for Onyx Path. Some people even are mad enough to want to develop our books.
Fools!
Yes. what naive, innocent fools they are. Now, to get into the writing, first of all, I think, Eddie, you're probably the man to tell the tale of what must people do if they want to freelance write for any of our projects.
So, at cons, when a lot of people ask, what's the one thing I need to know? And same answer is always the same, which is follow the guidelines, social guidelines. Because both at the original White Wolf and at Onyx Path now, I have been the person who receives the blind submissions, what we colloquially call the slush pile. And there's lots of reasons why the submission guidelines are important. But the big one is that there's a disclosure form that comes with it. And it seems like it's a irritating piece of administrative detail, but it is really important, because on the off chance that you submit something that we're already working on, we need you to disclose that it's okay that we look at this, because otherwise, legally speaking, we can't look at it. If we look at it, then we're liable, even if we just have parallel development. So by sign, so first thing I say, if you didn't sign the form, I can't even look at it, and usually I'll kick it back. Excuse me. But on top of that, we also have a short submission. We usually say 500 words of mechanics, 500 words of flavor, which is a good sense of, can you design as a game designer, and also can you write flavorfully? So knowing all of those pieces, just following instructions is very, very important.
Yeah. It's pretty open past that, though. Like, it's 500 words of mechanics, 500 words of setting, but, like, we don't say, like, it has to be for a specific game line, or you have to do this, or to do that. Like, you've got a lot of freedom to work with it. But, we've also gotten 4,000 words of missions, and I'm like, I'm not reading that.
Right, and that's the thing, is that the reason why it's short is it is twofold. One, from the contractor side, having been the opposite side of this, is that it's the least amount of use of your time. We're asking for 1,000 words, which is, if you've done this before, maybe an hour's work. If you haven't done this before, maybe it's a night's work. But it's not a ton of time. But we get usually 3 to 5 a week, and that's a lot to read through. We're looking at hundreds of submissions over the course of a year. And so if you do send us your 50,000 word novel, it's not going to get read. We just don't have the time for it. We have other stuff we need to be working on.
And I mean, at the same time too, I'm going to look at it and go, well, I didn't follow the rules, so obviously they're not going to write to outline.
And that's the other piece is I've had people try to say, well, if I send in this resume, it doesn't follow the guidelines, it'll stand out. It's like, you're correct. It stands out as someone who cannot follow instructions, and I will not hire you.
Yeah. I mean, pretty much though, because like so much of our work is writing like to spec or to outline. Right. We don't Like, it's nice if you have your own vision, and it's nice if you're bringing your own ideas, obviously. But we don't need someone who's going to go completely, you know, over to left field from what we asked them to write.
Yeah, and don't let this sound, I guess, too critical to you, the listener. The idea that we have these rules and procedures in place, that we have those guidelines, as Eddie and Dixie have said, to encourage people to actually follow the rules, to show that you can follow an outline, because every single one of our books is outlined.
Yep.
And also because it does you a favor, you don't have to write as much to show that you can actually follow those rules. And one thing I would like to add, one thing I'd like to stress, because I think this is something some people get confused by, if you're submitting work to us, that isn't the work we're going to publish.
Yeah, okay.
Some people will send the first 1,000 words of their novel, their source book, or their new game line, and that's wonderful. But when we recruit someone to work on a book, it's very, very rarely going to be on the book they have submitted to us. By all means, you can submit an idea, and if it passes muster and the guidelines we have in place, Eddie may well refer it on to Rich Thomas to review. But more likely than not, if you're an unproven writer, at least with us, we're going to want you to work on a source book, or more rarely a core book, that's being developed by someone else on the team at Onyx Path, before you start running away with your own project. And again, I know that probably sounds harsh. I don't want to destroy anyone's dreams, but everyone has to start somewhere. And honestly, the best practice you can get as a freelance writer is by working under another developer for a while, following an outline, working to a set word count, getting your work redlined, and learning what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong. So do you have anything else to add to the submissions process, Eddie?
The other, I think, piece that's important is, because we have a lot of developers, and a lot of people will look for different things. When I'm looking up the stuff, when you email the Onyx Path email address, I check that once a week. And also, to side note, my responses are always pre-programmed. I don't spend a lot of time engaging people, because that's not my job at this point. My point is just simply to check it, make sure it's valid, and then get it into the hands of the people. Then the Exalted developers or the Chronicles Darkness developers or whatever will then read through an archive of those to find people. So just the reason why we say we're not going to get back to you unless someone wants to hire you is because sometimes people have sat there for a couple of years, not because they don't like them, but because they weren't good tone for any projects at that time. But then a year or two later, another developer would go through and go, actually, that's really, really good. So when you're sending stuff in, don't get discouraged because you don't hear back right away beyond a boilerplate of we've received your submission. It may not be that you're bad. It may just be that you're not a good fit at the moment. And also, one thing that I think a lot of people miss on these submission guidelines is that if down the road you think your skills have improved, you've learned something from other companies, or you've put out stuff on Storyteller's Vault, and you feel like you've learned a lot and you want to resubmit, go ahead. You know, we keep all the stuff on file. And so having two or three pieces that we can look through and say, okay, cool. Well, you know, this one's kind of rough, but that one shows potential, more chance of hiring you. Make sure you send a disclosure form with each submission, however. Each one separately needs its own disclosure form. I've had a couple people just keep sending in things. I said they want a disclosure form. It's not like an NDA. Each one needs a separate disclosure form.
Right.
But yeah, don't get discouraged because you don't hear back right away. It's not because you're bad. It's because maybe we just don't have anything on deck for you at the moment.
Right. Like we, for Exalted, at least, we've been picking up some more steam recently and putting out more than one, like we're working on more than one book at one time at this point, which means that we're trying to get some new writers in. So we went through the submissions. There were, 60 or 70 of them, I want to say, in the Exalted folder when we opened it.
Yeah.
And we went through that, and there was like a maybe pile of like 10 or 12 people. And then they culled it down to like, I think, 6 new writers on this book, 5 or 6, mm-hmm. which is actually a large amount for a book. But because this book is one that we did through Kickstarter stretch goals, it has pretty definite parameters. So we figured it was a good one for some new folks.
Because each of those chunks would be like 5,000 words, right?
Yeah, exactly. Which was the thing too, is like if you're a new writer, you might only get 4,000 or 5,000 words on a book. you might only get 3,000 words on a book, but that's still a good way for us to kind of see your potential, see how you accept red lines, see where we think we can use you in the future if we like your work. So, yeah.
Matthew, that's one thing to kind of quickly note before Matthew's next question is all of our workload is tracked in thousands of words. So you often see things like, you know, 10K, 15K, 14.5K, whatever. Our book lengths, our assignments, everything is tracked by thousands of words. So that's our kind of unit of measure in OnyxPath.
Yeah, it's fairly uncommon that you would hire a single writer to write an entire book, unless that book was particularly short. So yeah, that's how we divide it up between word count, and you get paid per word, unless it's exceptional circumstances, but all writers are paid per word. And by all means, dear listener, if you are interested in writing any RPG content for us, do submit work. And as Eddie said, if you don't hear a response immediately or at all, don't be discouraged. I know that's very difficult, because anyone who has ever applied for a job ever sent their CV into the void and never heard anything back often feels a bit, you know, struck across the face. It isn't a good feeling. Yeah. And yet, especially in this industry, you need to keep plugging away to show commitment, to show that you're improving. And no one is going to hold it against you at our end if you send another submission 6 months after the first one to show that you can write something slightly different. If anything, that's only going to serve you, because your work's going to go across multiple folders. And Eddie mentioned 500 word system, 500 word setting. That is a fantastic measure to aim for. And I mean this in all seriousness. If you look at something like a discipline from Vampire game, and you imagine how that's laid out, it's approximately 200 to 500 words of what is this discipline, how did it originate, and how is it used. And then it's the first three dots of that discipline are around 500 words of mechanics. The first dot is, I don't know, making eye contact with someone and giving them a one-word command, that kind of thing. And having to mechanically lay it out as well as provide a little bit of flavor. The point is that by illustrating you can write a discipline, as an example, you are showing that you can write your interesting setting for why this justification for why this discipline exists, and you can also provide mechanical justification of how it works within the game. And you don't have to do a discipline, but almost every single one of our games, at least World of Darkness and Chronicles of Darkness wise, has something like that. And with the story path games as well, you will have things like stunts you can submit that fall within that parameter as well.
Edges.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a really nice sort of ground to aim for. That's just my recommendation, and something I personally look for when I'm looking through the folders of submissions that we've got.
Yeah. One thing too is that you can submit for multiple game lines if you want, especially because the flavor is so different between some of our different game lines. Like a submission for, you know, a Chronicles of Darkness game will definitely not look the same as a submission for, say, Pugmire or Monarchies of Mal,
right?
Just because the tones of the games are so different. So if you like two different lines or three different games pretty much equally, and you'd be happy to work on any of them, like, it's okay to send in submissions to different lines. Just because different people will see them too.
Yeah, one thing I've seen a lot of, and it's a really good point, is people will send a cover letter email in, and it's like, I've attached submission for Exalted, say, you know, but I would also love to work on Chronicles of Darkness or Vampire the Masquerade,
right?
For example. And it's like, that's cool, and I will let people know that. But because you're right, they're so totally different that it is better to resubmit for those game lines rather than just say, oh, I'm also interested in work for other things. Because that's not going to, A, it's there's so many people coming in that you're going to get lost in a shuffle if you don't have an actual submission on file for that game line. And B, you're right. I mean, I can't sometimes look at Exalted and see what tone is going there. On a flip side, when I did the Dystopia Rising open call, there wasn't a game system yet. We were still putting together which slice of story path we're going to use, and story path was not readily available to everyone. And so I said, I don't care what the game line you submit for or what mechanics you use, just use some mechanics.
Right.
And so I was really reading for, can they get the tone that I needed for Dystopia Rising? And can they put together halfway decent and understandable mechanics? So I had some people submit for like D&D mechanics. Some people submit Warhammer mechanics, some Savage Worlds, whatever. And that's fine because I wasn't looking at, are the mechanics correct? A little bit of that. But mostly I was like, does the tone of this feel right? Are they getting that right balance of post-apocalyptic vibe, but also slightly action-adventure elements? So you're right, absolutely right, Dixie. The tone of the submission and the ability to show competence in presenting mechanics that are flavorful and useful is way more important, and therefore it's harder to see through a different game line submission than you do.
Right, because like if I'm looking for writers for a new Exalted book, I'm not going to think to myself, let's go look in the Werewolf the Forsaken folder, you know? Like it's not the same thing. If I've got a writer that's been published on Werewolf the Forsaken, I can get a recommendation and I know they're into Exalted, then maybe. But even that, like, that's a whole convoluted chain that it's much easier just to look in the folder and be like, okay, these 15 are really good, let's narrow these down to 5.
Right.
It's interesting, isn't it? I hadn't really considered the tone point, but I think we've only had one, maybe two submissions for They Came From Beneath the Sea so far, and that's because it's a brand new game, and no one outside of the people who have playtested it and written it, I guess, know what the system is going to work like. But the submission I read was excellent to read, and I'm kind of dreading any further submissions we get in the future, because it's a game with a certain amount of humor and there'll be an awful lot of people inserting dreadful jokes about, I don't know, clams and so on. I'm gritting my teeth waiting for it, but if you can hit that mark, you draw my attention, you make me think, well, when we get to another book on this line, I will be going back into that folder and I'll be reaching out to you. So, yeah, that's a very good point regarding tone. I've got a question, something we didn't, because often, peek behind the curtain here, often we have a brief chat before these podcasts start recording. Of course, we don't just launch into a recording and we're ready, but we have a brief chat about some of the things we might talk about. We didn't talk about this, because you know I love my curveballs. My curvy balls. And this particular...
Never say that.
Please
again.
Phrasing, Matthew.
Phrasing.
Mm. So this particular curveball is regarding networking. We didn't talk about that, but it's something quite important in this field of freelancing. And again, any self-employed profession, but especially in the field of RPGs, something we were speaking about a while ago was how within this industry, a lot of us know each other. And so, I worked with that person for this company, and I worked for that person for this company. And so you might hire them based on that previous experience. But before you get into that circle, I guess, that industry, how do you even start that networking? How do you make yourself known as someone who's reliable? Or, to put a counterpoint on it, what would you have to do to make yourself not hireable? Dixie, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I can tell you, you know, like, we do look up some of the people that submit, and if you do really want to work on one of our game lines, but you've been on various internet forums or Facebook saying really nasty things about some of our game lines, I'm probably not going to hire you.
That happens way more than you think, too. Yeah. We're joking, but it happens way more than you think.
Like, it seems really obvious, but just like every office job now, we'll probably go look at your social media to make sure that you're not secretly a terrible person. We will also look that up. And if I connect a name to a forum handle or something, or someone's email address to a forum handle that is just constantly negative, then I don't know why I would hire that person. However, I have found that with getting into it and kind of becoming friendly, we have tons of Facebook discussion groups where we can kind of see various fans and potential writers interact. And there have been some people that have just been so wonderfully pleasant and positive all the time. Josh Heath.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That, he's an excellent example. I
want to work with them. Mm-hmm. Like he's writing a bit for one of my books right now, and he's pretty great. But like on Twitter, I've had really great interactions with people where they're talking about the podcast, or they're retweeting, or they're making a comment, and then I comment back, and then we end up chatting, and then I find out they've actually submitted, and I'm kind of more likely to put those people forward and kind of say, right, like, hey, this person seems pretty cool, and like they, you know, are really hungry for this work, and they're really passionate about the product, or, you know, whatever project it is. And like that's a good thing, because like we want you to be excited to work on our books. You know, we don't want this to be just another job. For a lot of us, I mean, most of us started as fans on some level. And yes, so seeing that same kind of passion from other potential hires, I think is really nice. Eddie?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing I would add is for a long time, the adage was find where your potential client is and have a drink with them.
Well, yeah, definitely.
there was definitely kind of a connection between freelance work and bars, not just in our industry, but our industry and creative industry in general. A lot of business happens in bars. I will say that speaking as someone who's disabled, I know that that can be very frustrating. And sometimes going to a bar is not easily accessed for people who are disabled or otherwise just don't have the ability or choose not to drink, can't be around the alcohol. But I think the larger point is relevant, which is to kind of build what you're saying, is just going where they're being social and just get to know them.
Yeah.
Because we as human beings, we want to help people that we like. I had a great conversation with a friend of mine a couple of years ago on the video game side. He does audio work. He's a composer and does a lot of audio editing work and the like. And he told me that one of the ways he gets jobs is by doing favors for people, because it goes to Maslow's gift theory. You know, if you do a favor for someone, don't ask for anything in return. They're kind of wired to want to give you something back. When someone says, oh, I didn't expect you to give me a gift, that's why you feel a little annoyed at them, because yeah. You're wired to you can't close the loop until you give them something. And that works to your advantage to a certain degree. If you're a nice person, you want to hang out with people and you buy them a drink and you just have a nice conversation, not necessarily even about work. When they see you again, they're going to want to close that loop. Yeah.
To be totally clear, Eddie isn't saying that we can be bribed.
It's not foolproof, because there's a danger to that. And I think it's to Matthew's other question is, if you're not comfortable in those kinds of situations, if you're not someone who feels like you can carry off that kind of conversation, it can sour. Know your audience to a certain degree. Like if someone comes to me, say, and wants to start chatting in a very loud location, it's not going to be a great experience because of my hearing loss. I'm not going to hear much of what you're saying. It's going to be frustrating for me. I'm going to feel obligated to kind of be polite, but I'm going to want to exit that. My whole thought's going to be, I just want to get out of this awkward situation. And for people who don't realize that I have hearing loss and don't realize that's awkward for me, I don't mean to think negatively of them, but that's going to sit in my head. It's like, oh, you were the guy that kept me pinned down when I was just trying to leave.
Oh, yeah. So we've all been pinned down by a fan or prospective writer or something at a convention.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've all had that one fan, and this can sometimes happen on social media as well. And social media is an interesting place for the networking part of freelance writing, mm-hmm. where... as Dixie pointed out with someone like Josh. Hi, Josh, if you're listening. we're singing your praises here, so we expect you to work for us.
You better be getting me my draft.
That's Maslow's theory. If you have a good reputation online, and by that I mean you are supportive to our game lines, you are supportive to the fans of our game lines, you're on our forums, you don't necessarily have to be our biggest promoter or our biggest marketer or anything like that. We don't expect that. But if you are putting a good face out there, then of course, naturally, we're going to look at your behavior and think, wow, this is the kind of person we want to work with. Conversely, you do of course have the critics, and criticism isn't a bad thing, but complaints, constant moans is.
Yes.
And somewhere in the middle ground, you have the big fans who think they're networking by constantly sending you messages, constantly tagging you, constantly inviting you to groups. Well, not inviting you, adding you to groups on Facebook. And this is a really hard line, and I'm not castigating these people, because I'm sure I have done it just as much as they have in my past. It's something you have to learn. But often people will push it too far. Their desire to network or be the friend of the person they want to work with will kind of, frankly, get on their nerves. It's like Eddie's saying about someone pinning you down in a very loud place. If someone keeps sending me messages on Facebook and I am giving what I deem a clear indication I do not want this conversation to go on, usually that's when I become monosyllabic,
right,
in my responses, or that's a good idea, thank you very much. That's my conversation closer. I just naturally become disinclined to want to converse with that person and potentially work with them, because I think, well, this person's never going to leave me alone.
You made a new best friend.
And that, yeah, but, you know, that all sounds incredibly mean of me. It sounds very critical of me, and this is us being slightly candid, I guess. It's a symptom of being in a position where there's an awful lot of people that see your name if they're interested in this industry.
Yeah, and well, I think it's good to remember that, you know, we are people, and as much as we all, well, as I say, I know I do, and I believe you both do as well, you try to be objective about these things.
Mm-hmm.
You try to look past as much as possible, but the reality is that we're human beings. There's an emotional component to this work, particularly in creative industries. There's a lot of overlap between our emotional needs and drives and our, you know, desire to do business. I mean, a lot of stuff we put into these products is because there's an emotional connection there. And as much as if there are some writers that are fantastic writers, they do amazing work. They absolutely should continue to get work for Onyx Path, but I personally don't click with them. So I don't think of them when I'm putting together my team, because someone who maybe is a little bit rougher, but I enjoy working with them, I'm going to want to reach out to them more often. And it's just how humans are, especially when you're on a project for 6 months, 9 months, a year. You know, you don't want to have someone that you kind of grate against. And again, we try to look past this stuff. I mean, we're all professionals. And if there's a situation where it makes the most sense to hire someone like that, we will do it. So it's not like you're banned forever because we don't like you. But that is a component that you have to remember.
Yeah.
So I'd like to move onto some happy stuff.
Yay.
And I'm going to point this at Dixie, first of all. This is, I guess, a bit of a tale question.
Okay.
Tell me a tale. I would like to know, as a freelancer, mm-hmm. about a project that you wish you could have worked on, or something that you're so glad you got to do, and why it was so fantastic.
Well, I mean, I just came on in February of this year as, like, a full-time freelancer. So I haven't seen many things through start to finish yet. That's still something that I'm working toward. As a freelance editor, when I was just working from home and mostly just talking to Rose Bailey about stuff, I can say that I was really, really excited to get to work on Changeling 20th, because I was a big Changeling fan when I was, you know, in high school. And so I always say that if I, you know, if you went back and told 16-year-old me that I'd be doing this, I would have been like, no. What? You're crazy. So that was really cool. I really enjoyed editing Becca's Jihad Diary once again, because, you know, Metaplot vampire fan since I was,
and very little work
much younger
to do, of course.
Oh yeah, yeah, it was so clean. I'm having a really good time working on my first development project. I'm working on a collection of ready to play adventures for Monarchies of Mao, the cat companion game to Pugmire. And so far, like, all I really had to do so far is, you know, write an outline and talk to the writers, but I'm getting to a point now where I'm going to be doing red lines in a couple weeks for the first time ever, and that'll be
so
fun.
Exciting.
Yeah, no, I'm very, very excited about that. There are a lot of things that I
red lines soon.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of things that I wish I could have worked on. Obviously, I wish I had been on staff around the time of Vampire 20th, just because that was such a huge, cool thing to have been, to have done. I've done some of the other, like, side projects for it, but I didn't get to work on the core or anything. And yeah, there are quite a few things that came out in the few years before I started that I'm like, aw, I wasn't here yet. But I'm very lucky to have gotten to edit pretty much everything for Pugmire and Monarchies at this point, aside from some smaller pieces. That's super cool, because I really feel like I've been there since the beginning on those.
And then when we do Pugmire 20th.
Yeah. Yeah. And in a while. Honestly, yeah, right? When I'm in my 50s. I was also really... my first Kickstarter, what has started... like 2 weeks after I started this job, and that was the Dragon Blooded Kickstarter for Exalted. I pretty much started this job, and like a week later, Rich was like, okay, we're gonna have a meeting about the Kickstarter. And I was like, okay. And I got all these questions. I'm like, I can't answer any of these. I'm just gonna go with what y'all think. But then to see how successful it was and how engaged the fans were, and even when I wrote a little update that said, like, full disclosure, I'm not as familiar with Exalted as I am with other game lines, so tell me what you think is cool about it. It was really cool to have some of the fans kind of be like, yeah, Dixie, you're super engaged. We're going to tell you what we like about this game so you can, you know, be more interested in it. And I'm like, yay. So it was really, really cool kind of getting thrown in the deep end on my first large Kickstarter right after I started. But I got to interact with the community a lot, so that was really awesome.
I'd like to flip the question over with Eddie. And this one's, I guess, a little more sensitive. Tell me about a project... a project that you have worked on as a freelancer that you wish you hadn't. Something that you wish you hadn't picked up. Because this ties in slightly to what you were talking to Danielle about last week about, or might be next week, who knows.
Next week, yeah.
Next time week, yeah, yeah, you know, I'm a time traveler. I've got the accent. I'm a doctor of something. that's good enough. Okay, a sneak peek. There's a little bit of conversation about, as a freelancer, when should you turn work down?
Right.
And it's something worth discussing in this podcast, I think, because we're talking about the life of a freelancer, how to get in, and the high points. What about the low points? So, Eddie, tell us about a project, and you don't have to name it, but I'd rather that you did, that you wish you hadn't taken on, and why that happened. Be the case.
So I'm actually gonna name names. It's been long enough that I could do that, and also I believe all parties are aware of my opinions at this point. But very early on in my career, I worked on a adaptation of a comic book called Tomorrow Nights. Have either of you heard it?
No.
Exactly. That's the correct reaction.
No.
And I
worked in a comic shop.
Right, exactly. It was 4 issues that was put together. It was part of Marvel's Epic creator-owned stuff back in the 90s, I want to say. It was 4 issues, and that was as far as I ever went. And they approached the company I worked with at the time, and they said they wanted to do an RPG adaptation of it. And, you know, there's we kind of didn't inherit the brief. My partner at the time, Cynthia Celeste Miller, we were heavily involved in the discussion. But in general, the business side was kind of far along by the time we came on board. And what we realized about halfway through was that they didn't know what a role-playing game really was.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't – and I've had this problem with other projects as well – is that there are certain IP holders and creators who, when they hear that people are going to be taking this game and inventing new stuff with it, they get a little concerned. They start to feel like, oh, are they going to sell this online or whatever? And also because we had only 4 issues of a comic to work with, there's a lot of background material we had to invent.
Right.
So we thought we were clear about this up front. When we started handing over manuscripts, the creators were very irate, and became very vocal about their displeasure. I did not react well, I will admit. But the upshot of it was that at the time I thought, well, we've committed to this project. We need to do what we can, and we need to satisfy the client. And I stand by a lot of that in theory, but one thing I've learned from that is, because I've worked on a lot of licensed stuff ever since. I've worked on Futurama, I've worked with Firefly, I've worked with Dystopia Rising, worked with WWE, and I always learn something new each time. But one thing that's really kind of came away from that is talking upfront with the license holder and saying, this is what needs to happen. This is what we're doing. This is what we're making. We're going to have you check in at various points. You know, we're not going to do anything you're uncomfortable with, but these are things that we have to do. And by clarifying upfront what that was going to be. So as freelancers come on board, talking with the developer, talking with your client, because your developer is your client in this relationship, talking with your client and saying, okay, here's your outline. I have a bunch of questions. Here's what I can bring on board. And I will say, to name drop again, this is one of the things I think all of us have seen, specifically with Steffi Devan. She's fantastic at this particular piece. She will ask you a ton of questions up front. But when she delivers pretty much exactly what you're looking for as a result.
Yeah, no, I would rather have somebody ask me for clarity on anything they're unclear on than just kind of try to mind read.
Yeah, I don't think we really went into it much on the development of the book episode, but it's certainly important to have that communication open between writer and developer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is why, I mean, absolutely. Like, every now and then we use Slack and stuff for that, and, like, speaking of Steffi, she's on an Exalted book right now, and I have seen her in the Exalted Slack asking just tons of questions that, you know, she wanted clarification on, and the developers are, you know, answering her, and it's probably going to go much smoother. Like, her drafts will likely be very clean because of this. So that's good to see.
So yeah, I think that all points to like you said, Matthew, is another key piece of the freelance experience is that particularly because in 95% of instances, you're going to be remote. So you're not going to be in the same building or in the same city or in the same location as your client you're working with. Being proactive and saying, I have a question. I need to know this. What's going on with this? I'm running into a problem. A tree's fallen on my house. Kids in the hospital, whatever. Being as proactive as possible in communication is a huge help because we can't change anything. We can't adjust things if we don't know what's going on. So it's, if you have two freelancers, both of which have a medical emergency, one of which says, here's what's going on. I don't have to go into medical details, but I have a medical emergency. I'm going to be out for this many days. I'll be this late. And I'll get you what I can when I can. I can hand over what I've completed right now if you need to move ahead. And another developer who just goes radio silent, does not answer emails. It's two completely different experiences from a developer perspective. Even though they may deliver their drafts the exact same time, that first person, I'm going to definitely give them work again and work with them. I'm going to have better experience redlining them than the second person.
Yeah, I was working on something. I don't remember what the project was a couple years ago. And I had a death in the family. And, like, Rose was the first person I reached out to, pretty much. After I, like, made travel arrangements and talked to my boss at my day job, I reached out to Rose and I said, hey, this happened. I even said, I'm going to try to work while I'm down in Atlanta dealing with this. I did not get any work done. I sat there at my laptop a couple times and was just like, nope, can't do this. But, you know, I reached out to her and she was totally cool with it. I was about a week late on that because I was in Atlanta for a week. But yeah, no one got mad at me and I kept getting work. And I had the same thing even when I was in college. Like, I had a death in the family, and after I talked to everybody else, my professors were the first people I called. And I was going like, hey, I'm gonna be, like, it's midterms, I know, I'm working on this, I'm sorry, is this happening? And they were super understanding. And it's the same thing with us. Like, if you as a developer have any issue going on, whether it's a personal issue or a work issue with your day job or whatever, like, just tell us. And we're, once again, we are people. We do understand things like work-life balance and personal life issues and whatever. All of us have had them too. Like, it's not like we're machines and we're always here and perfect. You know, we have our own issues.
And we're not perfect.
Well, we even have to communicate to each other, you know, if something's going on, whether it's a medical issue or a personal issue, whatever, like, generally, if that kind of thing happens, we'll, you know, send an email out to our, like, meeting team and be like, hey, I'm out today for this reason. Here's why. I'll be back tomorrow. You know?
Just as you would with any other employer, if you were, you know, if you were expected to turn up to work, and you were able to get to the phone to call and say, I'm going to be late, or I can't come in today, I've got pneumonia,
right.
or whatever, you would probably do it rather than let them worry and have to guess where you are. But no, that's an incredibly valid point. And something I would like to get onto regarding the freelancer experience, and I mean specifically the writer's experience,
mm-hmm.
is regarding red lines. You mentioned them earlier, Dixie, that you're fast approaching your first redlining phase as a developer.
Yeah.
And this might be something Eddie or myself can speak on most. It's, let's say you're a freelance writer. You get your first set of red lines. It may not even be your first set of red lines, your second or third set of red lines. And they are quite, the word brutal is often used, or bloody.
Extensive.
It looks like a draft has been murdered. Extensive. That's the nice way of putting it. Because it's very easy to joke about red lines. And for the sake of clarity, if you've not listened to the episode, very briefly, red lines are the phase where the developer will look over your first draft. So you've taken an assignment, 20,000 words. You've got to write 20,000 words about the rise of Islam. And I had to do this for Mummy the Curse, the era surrounding the rise of Islam. And I had to do 20,000 words on it. And I submitted my first draft off to the developer. And I waited for red lines to come back. Now, in the scenario that document came back and was absolutely covered with red, it's quite often joked about that it's been murdered or brutalized or what have you. But a good developer will be providing instruction, a bit of direction, highlighting the positives, underlining the negatives, providing advice on what needs changing, maybe proposing a setup of a meeting and so on. But Eddie, right. as you, the writer, have received many red lines in your time,
yes.
how do you handle when those red lines are particularly, I guess, vicious, as you would put it, extensive?
So, it's easy to talk as a professional to say, mentioned before, criticism is natural, thread lines are part of the process, no first draft survives contact with the client. I mean, we all intellectually understand this. I still sometimes get an emotional reaction when I get extensive red lines. So it doesn't go away. It gets better. It doesn't last as long. And certainly I've learned different methods, but there are times where I'll open a document, look at it, and just close it, have a drink, get over my initial reaction before I look at them again. And sometimes I have to tell myself it's making the book better, it's making the product better, so on and so forth. But one thing that, if you have a good developer or a good client, that if they give you extensive red lines, is they'll give you some kind of guidance. I actually take a sidestep and I'll say that my first couple of scripts for Futurama, the Game of Thrones game I worked on, I got pretty heavy red lines on those, which were a lot of things. A combination of the script wasn't very tight. It wasn't doing certain things. There were limitations, but also I was still trying to find the voice of the material. Even though I was a huge Futurama fan, it's one thing to hear it in your head and watch it and appreciate it. It's another thing to transcribe that in a way that the license holder finds, yes, that is the product you're writing for. I think we've given you a license for. And so a lot of my first drafts were pretty heavily redlined, both by the people who wrote the original cartoon and also by Dave Grossman, my partner at the time, who's worked on seminal video games like Treasure Island or Pirate, lots of the original like Phantom Max games. He was one of the founders of Telltale Games. I mean, this guy's amazing. So I learned a ton from it. But at the time, it didn't feel like that. At the time, it felt like, oh, I'm terrible. I suck at this. So when you're looking at that kind of stuff, one thing I did was try to extract commonalities and extrapolate that. So if I'm getting red lines that says, capitalize this, capitalize this, capitalize this, I should be doing that through the whole manuscript, not just every instance I see. If I'm saying, don't use that here because it makes the character a little more passive. Then if I've given that character the word that in similar sentences, I need to also correct those. It seems like it's more work. And it seems counterintuitive because especially if you're feeling bad about the red lines, you want to just get them done as fast as possible. I've learned to fight that instinct because it will help you in the long term. Because if you catch that stuff that they didn't catch, the worst case scenario is they won't notice it. The best case scenario is, oh, thank you for catching it. I was going to mention that too, but I didn't get to it or whatever. And they'll feel more confident in your work. But on the flip side, also, if the red lines are particularly aggressive, let's say, reaching out to your client and say, hey, you know, I'm reading through your stuff. I understand your concerns. Going forwards, I would appreciate it if you provided things a little more neutral, instructive tone rather than telling me this is, you know, play terrible and you're awful and, you know, God, this is awful. Certain clients they may have a shorthand internally where that kind of loose talk is fine, or maybe they still understand how it's coming across in text, or it's maybe the first time in some clients' cases doing this stuff. And they just don't realize that, wow, someone's being, you know, offended and hurt by this. So on the flip side, if you do find that there are questions or concerns, or if you don't agree with the red line, it's okay to have the conversation, understanding that the client ultimately has the final say. And at the end of the day, if they're like, nope, this is how it's going to be, I'm not changing my process, then cool, then we'll finish the project up. I'm not going to ask for more work from you or whatever. But it is a conversation. Red lines should be ideally a conversation between them, just understanding that one party ultimately has final say. But you don't have to necessarily blindly take on things. Think about what's being said. Think about what's being implied. And consider all the ramifications of that, both positive and extrapolating through, and negative and saying, actually, this sets up a bad precedent, and I don't want to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the difference between constructive criticism and criticism, you know? Right. If you're, like, I've obviously not, like they said, done red lines yet, but I did work for a newspaper in college where I did do red lines. And I also, in editing books, I do tend to make comments. And I find that I sometimes am a little bit more brutal and sarcastic if I know the writer isn't going to be seeing my commentary, if I know that it's just a developer that's going to be seeing it that didn't write on the book. Mm-hmm. Whereas my comments, when I know it's going to a writer, I try much harder to just be like, hey, do you think this could be phrased a different way? Because it's a little like hard to read, or I didn't really understand this the first time I read it. Maybe rephrase it this way. Because, I mean, you've seen my comments on like Pugmire and Mao and stuff, Eddie. Like, I also try to point out things that I think are fun. Like, if I think something's really fun, yes, or funny, I'll, like, make a little comment where I'm like, this is great. I love this joke. Even though it's not a comment that's necessary, I think it's still nice to hear. So, like...
My favorite moment was when you worked on Mao, is every time Rat King was a sentence, you would go, The Rat King! And nothing to do with the editing process, but it made me feel like you were just having just as much fun in this project as I was. And so our relationship was really strong as a result of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like I said, so I come from a very heavy retail background. Like, I've never really done office work before this. So my retail background means that, like, I'm used to having to coach people, but coach them in such a way that you don't insult them, because you don't want to just, like, you can't pull somebody off the floor and be like, what the hell are you doing? You know,
right.
Pull somebody off the floor and be like, hey, I saw the way you interacted with that client. Like, you know, maybe in the future you could really do this, you know, whatever. Like, are you okay? Like that kind of thing. And so, like, I've already been kind of thinking about it with red lines, and probably most of my comments are going to say things like, hey, I like this, but maybe we could do it this way, you know, whatever. Like, I can't imagine that I'm going to be harsh on any level, unless I also can't imagine that any of these free writers are going to get anything that's crappy, but yeah. But we'll see.
It's an interesting thing, because one of the things I often find myself highlighting in red lines as a developer is too many adverbs. You know, get rid of these wishy-washy terms. I don't want to know if something is slightly bad. I want it to be bad.
Right.
Then when I leave commentary, I will say, I think this could do with quite a bit of changing. Please, could you amend this slightly? So I just fill my commentary with adverbs, because if you're actually providing someone with constructive criticism without adverbs, you come across as a dick.
Right.
So don't take my comments as the way you should write. And I should say, because we've given a bit of a shout out to at least a couple of authors here. I've taken on new authors on some of my most recent books I've been doing as developer, and to name a few of them, who I don't think they will mind my saying that on their first drafts, their red lines were, as you would expect, quite heavy, quite extensive.
Yep.
And these writers would be Clara Herbel, Hilary Sklar, Bianca Savazzi, John Burke. These are all new writers we've had, but these are all new writers that I've then rehired, because come their final draft, I have seen how much they've listened, how much they've improved. They've applied these changes throughout their draft, and they've changed parts I didn't instruct them to, but for the better. And then come their subsequent draft, whether it's been on an Onyx Path book or a book for one of the other companies I've worked for, like Cult for Helmgast, because I'm also developing books for Cult Divinity Lost. I've seen their work improving time on time, draft on draft. And that's wonderful to see, because as a developer, you're getting to witness a writer developing. You're not just developing the book, you're developing them as a teacher and a trainer. And as I used to be a trainer, that was my profession before I got into this full time.
Right.
And it's always wonderful, very gratifying to see someone's personal improvement in a professional capacity. I wanted to throw that out there, because there's something incredibly rewarding to us as developers when freelance writers, and any of you who might be listening who want to get into this or who already have started, when you show signs of improvement, it not only makes our lives easier, it makes our jobs a hell of a lot more fun. We do start doing what both Eddie and Dixie mentioned about, getting quite lighthearted in the commentary. For instance, if someone keeps using the word that in their draft, by the 12th excess use of the word that, I will leave a comment that will say something like, the next that I see will be hiding underneath your bed and murder you in your sleep. or something equally as
pleasant.
that's pleasant, lovely.
because you know, while you're teaching and training and improving your writers, you're also making this job as lighthearted and fun as it should be. We're writing games, you know. We're not writing academic texts. We don't need to be 100% critical 100% of the time. And I guess I think my last question, because we are getting quite close to the end of this podcast, and it turns out we've got a lot more to talk about on freelancing than we thought, is about the life of the freelancer, and see whether we can fit this into 10 minutes. But
well, we can talk for a little bit longer than if we have to.
Well, I can't. I've got dinner to go to, but you can spend your time doing it. I'll just leave. a hostless podcast, why not?
We'll be butterless. We'll drift.
like every interview I'm not sat in on.
That's true.
So for the two of you who... Eddie, you've of course been doing this a lot longer than Dixie or myself, but for the two of you, juggling this, the work-life balance. Well, I know we've spoken informally before about the need to get out of the house, stretch your legs, work in interesting environments so that you're not just constantly in your flat or your house. But Dixie, how do you achieve, or do you not think you have yet achieved, a healthy work-life balance as a freelancer?
I honestly think that's something I'm still very much working on. I have a tendency to work probably longer than my allotted time I have to work every week, because I don't have much else to do. I'm moving in a little bit here, and so once I get to my new place, I'll have roommates, so I think that'll probably help a lot, because I'll, you know, probably get up and go have dinner with them and stuff. But my tendency that I started when I was working full-time retail and then coming home and doing this, which is to be at the computer pretty much the whole time I'm home, to eat at the computer, to do all that, is still very much wired into me. And I've been trying to, like, force myself out of the house on the weekends and force myself to not do more work when I don't have to and force myself to stop after, you know, eight, 9 hours, whatever. But I've had some difficulty with that, because my brain is very much like, well, there's still work to get done. But I'm also the kind of person, like, when I was in college, I was working 3 part-time jobs and taking more than a normal course load of credits. So I'm just that kind of person where I tend to take on a lot of work and then just power through it and maybe not even realize how much I've taken on until I get really into it. And then I'm like, oh God, what am I doing to myself? Because there was one college semester where I was taking, like, at my school credits were done a little bit differently, but I was taking 24 credits and working 3 jobs. And like, when I started freelance editing, I was working 2 jobs and then editing at night and on the weekends. And so I had very, you know, very little social life. And, yeah, I've been getting better about it. I've been forcing myself to stop working at, like, you know, 6:30, 7 o'clock. And even if all I do is go sit on the couch and watch TV or talk to somebody online or whatever. But yeah, I'm a bit of a workaholic. And I've been setting timers and stuff recently, which has been very helpful. And actually going like, okay, it's time to shut it down. It's dinner time. I'm not going to work anymore after this. Has been really, really nice. But for me personally, that's been a transition that's been a little bit rough to get used to.
I had no idea that I was so embedded in my work and have been for, even before I was doing this full time, when I was doing the training role and I was doing freelance writing and development in my evenings and weekends, for how long I've been working at this click. Because when I went on holiday recently, it was the first night we were there. I'd unpacked, we'd been out for dinner, got back, put my boy to sleep. People were just sort of lounging around at that point. And I as I mentioned on another podcast to come, I deactivated my Facebook. And I just thought, shit, what do I do now? This sounds quite hyperbolic. I promise it wasn't. Because when in my evenings, usually, I've got some kind of activity. If I'm not working, I'm going out. If I'm not going out, I'm doing something. And I was on holiday. And I had this evening, and everyone else was there quite happily relaxing. No one wanted to just play a game or invest in a movie or anything like that. They just wanted to chill out. And I couldn't. Not on that first night, anyway. I was just thinking, I can't settle to read a book. I just don't know what to do with myself. And that really jarred in my head that, okay, maybe when I'm at home I need to dial it back a little, because this isn't a healthy way to be. I shouldn't be constantly switched on to work.
Yeah, I've always been one of those people that's had trouble, like, shutting my brain off anyway. Like, my dad and my stepmom are totally comfortable to lounge around on a beach all day reading books and having people bring them drinks. And that sounds terrible to me. Like, when I go on vacation, I'm one of those people who's like, I want to go sightseeing. I want to go do stuff. I want to go shopping. I want to go to museums. And, like, I think that's just a facet of my personality, that even when I am relaxing, I am often, like, both watching TV and doing something on my phone or listening to a podcast and playing a game. Like, I am so often multitasking that it's very difficult for me to be like, relax. What's relaxing? And I mean, it's good to have that drive on some level, but at the same time, you do have to kind of realize that it's okay to slow down a little bit sometimes, and it's okay to take a night off, and it's okay to take a day off if you're not feeling well. Like, I've forced myself to work so many times when I was feeling ill, because I was like, well, it has to get done. And then it's like, no, everybody will understand if you take a day off. Like, it's fine.
Well, and that's, I think, key, is that if you're going to be a successful freelancer, and particularly if you eventually have the ability to go full time, like we all have, you have to be self-motivated. And it's interesting because a lot of the advice you'll see online will be contrary to what we've just been talking about. It'll be like, you know, don't procrastinate, don't turn on the TV. You know, if you have an extra half hour, try to fill it with work. And I think that that's valid to a certain degree. Most of the successful freelancer people I know, like you guys and other peers in the industry, are the kind that work 50, 60, 70 hours a week sometimes.
Yeah, easily.
That's why I was kind of laughing. People are like going, oh, you work for yourself. You have all this free time. It's like, no. There's been plenty of times where the rest of my family are off on vacation. I'm in my office working. So, I mean, there is a certain amount of you work hard when you're doing this because there's nobody else to do it. Everything that needs to get done, you have to do. You don't have other employees. There's no other contractors.
I edited a big chunk of Monarchies of Mal while I was in North Carolina for my best friend's wedding. Just right. Sitting in the Airbnb, working on a book.
Right. So, I mean, a lot of this is we end up, each person's idiosyncratic. Their work-life balance is just different. There are people I know who genuinely will work like 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. and then sleep during the day. And that's just, it really works better for them. You know, some people who work 15-hour days, some people work really hard for 4 days a week and have 3 day weekends, whatever. Because we're a freelancer, as long as you're getting work done on the client's timetable, it doesn't really matter how you structure your day. Occasionally you have to make sure that, you know, you wear a clean shirt for when you do video conferences with your client or whatever. But I mean, ultimately you do what you have to do. The problem is that I see a lot of people who are getting started have to be pushed into, no, you can't just sit around. You have to get out of old habits of jobs where someone's going to tell you what to do. You have to be proactive and you have to work harder. And so that's valid. But when you've reached this stage where things are starting to roll and move forward, then you have to kind of also pull back a bit. And that's, I find often I'm giving the opposite advice. It's like, okay, well, yes, but give yourself room, give yourself time to do things, because I've burned out. I've been in a place where I've been like, I don't want to look at another RPG project. I have quit the industry once and come back. There's been times where I quit other projects. I'm like, I just can't do this anymore. The past decade, I've gotten a lot better about it because I have lots of experience of figuring out where my levels are. And there's been once in a while where I've had to go to usually clients I know really well, like Rich, and just be like, I'm going to need a couple days off. I know your stuff's behind. I need a couple days to refresh. Luckily, I've built up enough collateral that I can do that occasionally. But also, you have to kind of know this is where the line is. Like you said, Matthew, it's like I've experienced those vacations where the first day or two, it's like, what do I do? And then eventually you kind of, oh, okay, after a couple of days, you kind of settle in. At least I've found I settle in. It's like, all right, it's not as bad as that. And you start to remember how to relax. And of course, by then it's already over and you know, you have to go back to work again.
yeah, damn it all, as I found. But you know, I definitely don't want this to seem like what a horrible profession we have, toiling away.
Oh no, not at all.
That's you know, we wouldn't do it if we didn't love it. And I think to conclude at least this portion of our freelancing podcast, I'm sure we'll return to it at some point. I wanted to just very briefly speak about this, I guess, workaholic ethos, which isn't necessarily a bad thing.
No.
When I was working full-time in my trainer gig and I was writing and developing books in the evenings and weekends, quite rightly, anyone who would observe that from the outside would think, this guy just doesn't stop working. He's just working and working and working. And I was. And I was enjoying it. And in some cases, it was to the detriment of other things, because sometimes you do have to sacrifice some things for the benefit of others. And I very much came to view the entire process, especially when I got to the end of it, when I was able to do this full time. And I realized I could do this full time from the end of last year, which was prior to my getting hired by Unexpired. I thought, okay, I'm getting enough contracts now. I can rely on this at this point. I look back on the last 4 years or so as equivalent to working full time and doing a college course in the evening.
Yeah,
it was like
much.
I was doing creative writing courses every night. And just as I would have had to have spent time studying and writing essays and doing presentations in front of the rest of the class to show that I was getting it if I was going to college, in my case, what I was doing was writing a certain number of words every evening and presenting it to my developer, getting it reviewed and potentially getting it published. While that was, of course, stretched over a 4-year period, and so the number of books I'm working on right now is probably equivalent to about half a year's work in year two of my, I guess, apprenticeship as a freelance writer. Now, I can look back on it and think, all that time I spent working myself, sometimes to my wit's end, but always rewardingly, was preparation for being able to do it full time. Everything I've learned during that time has allowed me to work slightly less now. And it may not sound it based on my anecdote about the holiday, but now I can, if I want to, take an evening off. I can take a day off. It's like Eddie said, if I can't do it at any point, and this would apply to any of you listening who want to get into this profession, if there's times you can't, if there's times you need the distraction of playing a video game or watching TV or whatever, you can do it because your hours are your own. And once you put the grift in, you've worked your ass off to get to that place, I guess, you can use all of the experience you've gained to essentially fall back on it and think, okay, I'm cool. I don't need to stress over this. I can pace my week out differently. I can pace my month out differently, or just my day. And I find now that I'm a hell of a lot more relaxed being able to do this full time than when I was juggling multiple jobs and,
right,
you know, across multiple industries. And I know, Dixie, to some extent, you're still doing that. And
I mean, kind of, but
all kudos to you.
But at the same time, when I was really, like, when I was at Sephora full-time and doing this in the evenings and weekends, like, I could easily go weeks without ever turning on my television or, you know, doing any, like, or reading a book that wasn't an RPG book. And now I do find that even if I don't shut it all down until 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, I still have an hour or two, if I want, where I can sit on the couch and relax and, you know, do my thing. And sometimes I will put in a 12-hour day just because I feel super motivated, and I'll do 12 hours of work, and then the next day it'll hit, you know, 2 p.m., and I'll be like, I'm going to go to the comic shop. I'm going to just go get coffee. Like, I am tired. I don't want to work for a second. And that's another thing you have the freedom to do. So, yeah, like, as long as you're still communicating and, you know, answering emails in a timely fashion, it doesn't really matter if you step out for an hour or have a car appointment or whatever. Like, that is a nice freedom that I really like working from home, is that if it's mid, like, I prefer going grocery shopping in the morning because there aren't as many people there. And
that's wonderful.
Yeah, so I can sit there and go, okay, it's 10 a.m. on a Tuesday. I'm going to go grocery shopping. And then I'll come back and just work a little bit late tonight, you know?
I do the exact same thing. Yeah, I do the exact same thing with swimming mid-morning. Everyone else is working in the office, so I get to have an entire swimming pool to myself. That's how I get out of the house and stretch, so I'm not constantly in a seated position. I go swimming when there's no one else there. It's wonderful.
Yeah. No, it's pretty great.
Since this is leading towards a natural ending, I'm going to interfere and I'm going to grab the microphone from you, Matthew. I'm going to cut a promo on you. It's part of our obligatory wrestling reference.
What's the swerve, brother?
The swerve for me is, do you think, now that you've gone full-time freelance, that you have improved as a person? That you've learned something about yourself, that you've become a better person as a result? Or do you feel like it's just another job?
Oh, good Lord. That's a deep and meaningful question with no preparation whatsoever.
Vengeance.
No, I feel this is a harsher question than asking Dixie to come up with a Chronicles of Darkness game for us to profile on one episode. But still. through my prevarication, I may have just come up with an answer. Do I feel I have become a better person? Well, I am definitely a more satisfied person. I certainly attain a great deal more job satisfaction now than I did this time last year, which likely makes me an easier person to get on with. It means that I have more time to myself. Again, contrary to my anecdote, because I'm able to space out my day and my week, I can take my son swimming if I want to, and I don't have to worry about juggling two jobs now. And so I do every weekend. We go swimming because I can work my weekend around that. So to get deep and meaningful about it, I suppose the time allows me to be a more attentive father and hopefully husband as well. But in terms of whether it makes me a better person, by and large, I suppose that's up for other people to judge. I certainly feel happy.
I was more trying to think if you feel better about yourself.
Yeah, I feel happier. I feel happier now than I did when I was pursuing a career that I was definitely good at, but wasn't coming home. I wasn't coming home from that career every day feeling a sense of satisfaction. Whenever a book comes out that I've worked on now, I can think, yes, I did that. I contributed to that. Mm-hmm. And now I get that, well, at the very least, every other month. So that's a damn good feeling to have. Well, thank you for that question, Eddie.
And that's a nice thing to end on.
Yeah, I'm not going to spin it around to everyone else because I've got to go. So where can we find you on social media, Eddie?
You can find me at just about any social media sites by typing in Eddie Fate, EddyFate, or you can go to my website, eddyfate.com.
And Dixie?
Same thing. You can find me on just about any social media site at Dixie Cyanide. That's Dixie like my first name, Cyanide like the poison.
And you can find me on YouTube as The Gentleman Gamer, the Onyx Path forums as The Gentleman Gamer, Twitter as Clack Click Bang, and Facebook as Matthew Dawkins. And please, don't take my complaint about persistently messaging me as invitation to not message me. If you want to message me, to compliment me, to tell me how fantastic my books have been, then by all means do so. But now you know the signal. Now you know the signal. If I say thank you very much, that means you can piss off. And on that... on that happy note...
Thank you for squandering all the goodwill I built you up for.
Many worlds, one podcast.